In this episode of Biz Trends, we explore the intersection of artificial intelligence, language, and African innovation, focusing on Google's role in shaping our continent's digital future. Kabela Makwane brings more than two decades of ICT leadership across global technology companies, including Microsoft, Cisco, and Accenture. And he now leads Google South Africa's mission to make technology more inclusive, accessible, and empowering for Africans. Our conversation today will delve into how AI and vernacular language technologies are unlocking new educational and economic possibilities, and how Africa can leapfrog traditional development pathways by embracing digital transformation. My name is Brandon Williams, and let's get into it. So, Kabela, at the recent AI Empowered conference, you spoke about Google's investment in African and vernacular language technologies in particular. Yep. Can you unpack what this means and why this is going to be important for our continent?
Thanks, Bronwyn. It's a pleasure to be here. yes, I think if you look at the AI language models, the large language models, at their very core and design, they are meant to be models that are contextually aware, are accessible to everyone. And this is, by the way, you know, in line with Google's mission, you know, to organize, you know, the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful to everyone. So how can it be universally accessible and useful to everyone if people in deep rural areas are not able to interact with these language models in their own native, you know, dialects and languages? So this is kind of what sparked the discussion. If you recall, not that long ago, we were on a similar mission around making search in Google also, you know, multilingual and accessible to people who, you know, would want to use the search engine, right? So the translation into Setswana, isiZulu, isiXhosa, Afrikaans is an imperative, and of course Swahili, of course. So these projects are projects that we instituted from an Africa perspective because our job, my job in South Africa is to advocate for the local context and make sure that that local context gets taken into account in how we develop products and how we shape innovation within the global, you know, big Google. So it was with this in mind that we partnered also with the South African, you know, Pan-South African Language Board to localize these language models and to translate something that was developed solely in English originally into our local languages. And we started with, you know, just 100 words. And today, based on crowdsourcing, you know, that lexicon has grown. And primarily the languages that are in view are isiZulu, isiXhosa, Afrikaans, and soon, you know, the 11 official languages will be incorporated as part and parcel of AI models so that people can feel included as well as make it actually universally accessible to anybody. If you think about technology being accessible, it's not just about, you know, making it available in rural areas. It's also about the accessibility in the use of the technology that becomes important.
I think it goes beyond the accessibility of the technology towards also questions around commercialization. So I've done some work with one of the portfolio boards with the CSIR in South Africa, who had long ago created these African language basically models ahead of what was happening with you know, AI in the commercial space. But finding that link to fund it to commercialize it has always been a challenge. Yeah. So from your perspective, how do your investments here fit in with Google's corporate vision for the continent?
Yeah, so the reality of it is that for the technology to be useful in the African context, it has to be relevant. And we also have a very clear strategy, you know, five-year strategy from an Africa investment point of view. And this is in line with that strategy of bringing about African-initiated and African-led innovation. Google has always been at its DNA, at its core, an open source company, right? A lot of our technologies When we build code, we bring it out into the open source community, and people actually use that code to then innovate and build solutions and build technologies that also become exportable to the rest of the world. So it's not just a north to south, it's also a south to north type of equation. To that extent, we've also built an AI innovation hub in Accra in Ghana. We've landed a Google Cloud region in South Africa earlier this year, and we launched it at the beginning of the year. And this is just some of the things that to talk to the pledge that Google made to invest $1 billion in this market, you know, over the next 3 to 5 years. To date, through Google.org, we have, you know, issued grants to the tune of $7 million to different institutions, the Wits DeepMind Institute, University of Pretoria, and a few other academic institutions, as part and parcel of supporting master's programs and PhD programs from a research and development point of view, because it's not just about, you know, technologies that are, let's call it, commercialized and resold into the market. It's also about how do these platforms become a basis for people to build technologies that could be exported in the rest of the world. A good case in point, for instance, is the weather forecasting solution was actually an African innovation, which is now finding relevance in the rest of the world, given the global climate changes and challenges that we are all facing. This is just but one example. Even in terms of language localization, Notebook LM, which is effectively your AI agent that helps you with deep research and consolidating vast amounts of research material into, you know, cogent, concise research documents, also is available now with over 50 languages across the globe. So these types of things are actually very practicable in terms of how Africa can contribute to the rest of the world.
So how are you going about doing that in practice? You mentioned some of your academic partnerships and some of the hubs that you're setting up, but in practice, how are you actually training these models based on what source data, especially given in the African context, so much of the cultural and knowledge resources lie in oral tradition? Yeah. How are you going about in doing this? And to add an extra layer of complexity to that question, I often find there's a lot of irony around the discourse around training of language models, especially when it comes to inclusivity, accessibility, like we're talking about, but also in terms of issues of copyright and that sort of thing. So on the one hand, you have a discourse with academics saying they want more vernacular content to be reflected and more African ideas to be reflected in the models that we use for all the reasons that we've spoken about, which are indisputable. Yeah. But at the same time, you find the actual creators of that content not wanting to share that content, which kind of puts people like you who want to solve this problem into a catch-22. So maybe if you could just talk to that point as generally or specifically as you feel comfortable as your PR department will allow.
No, it's a great provocation, Bron. And I think if I maybe just address the copyright challenge more directly, I think it's common knowledge now that we've been engaged with the South African Competition Commission and, you know, around some of the, let's call it, you know, the reports that were published around how do we protect intellectual property from, you know, from the media journalistic industry. And to date, actually, if I fast forward, we've been actually the most proactive global multinational in working with them to find solutions that will serve the local industry, because we believe that industry is absolutely, absolutely critical for content creation and also journalistic freedom and news content, right? Having said that, though, there's a piece of this which is about the world is changing, the world is moving in terms of how, you know, technology is being used and embraced in this space. And to that extent, we are fostering, you know, that industry to embrace technology and to be pro-innovation as opposed to kind of standing still, because the world is going to shift, right? And we don't want them to be left behind. So to that extent, our agreement with SAC has been to also make available resources and also tools, skills, and capacity generation capabilities to that sector. We've made the agreement with them to support the journalistic industry, especially also emerging and small sort of media and publication houses, as well as with the larger ones, right? Mm. And that process is ongoing. So the view from our perspective, as far as AI models is concerned, if you think about Vertex AI perspective, for instance, Vertex AI allows our platforms, our core fundamental platforms like Gemini, for instance, to be accessed at a code level where they can actually create their news content and publications using these models and actually build their own models, right? So it allows for them to access our platforms at a TPU and GPU level. So this is bare metal, right? And code level. And they can then develop models, if they so wish, that can enable them to actually accelerate into the modern era around how they deliver news content and their publications. Over and above that, in search, which was one of the report findings, we've introduced banners, right? And the banner is a South African flag banner, which identifies a local content and prefers that content so that users who are searching for content recognize that this is South African local content. And then it creates more, let's call it, visual preference for that content. So there's a lot that we're doing beyond, just immersing and training and making sure that people take full advantage of these platforms to the benefit of their businesses and how they transform, right? So that's from a commercialization point of view and a copyright point of view. I think in broad scope in general, from an accessibility and how people build innovation, we've got technologies such as anti-gravity in these large language AI models. Anti-gravity basically puts us in the realm of integrated development around agentic AI, right? It allows for the management of autonomous agents and the building of autonomous agents by whomever, right? And autonomous agents can solve problems like managing your supply chain logistics to managing your schedule, right? It could be that fundamental. But you create the next layer, the next evolution of how AI and large language models can be used for productivity gain and for efficiency. And this is something that local developers can take full advantage of. So this is by no means closed systems or closed platforms. In actual fact, the code itself is open to people, developers, who want to take advantage of that and build their own innovations on that platform.
So you speak about productivity gains there, and that's really what I wanted to get into with you next. Yeah. And that is, what's in it for us as Africans when it comes to engaging with vernacular AI? And what's in for us in two directions, firstly being from a labor perspective in terms of how can this help close skills gaps? How can it improve education? How can it empower individuals to be competitively fit for a globalized and increasingly automated world of work? Yeah. And very similarly to that, how does this help local businesses become more competitive in a globalized world?
Yeah, that's a lot of questions in one, but if I can just unpick them, there's a view that says for the longest of time, a QWERTY keyboard was actually a hindrance to how people adopt technology, right? Until there was the popularization of mobile, right? And with mobile, touch became the interface through which engage with technology. We've evolved now where natural language and natural interactions have become commonplace. How unnatural does it become when, let's call it, a khart, who's a farmer, is not able to speak to a large language model in Afrikaans? How unnatural is it when a sipo in Umkungundlov is not able to interact with this technology and actually program these models in their natural language? That's what we are. That's the aim, right? It's that level of fundamental inclusion that we are striving for, right? And to that extent, being able to then, you know, capture innovation at that grassroots level for those people who are wanting to solve for their real world problems, you know, real life problems, you know, in a farmer type of setting, which is a very big component of our focus in the African context, with, you know, with health, you know, food security, education, as you so aptly pointed out. It's about solving for, you know, how do I actually optimize my crop and yields, right, over a particular farming season. And these tools are absolutely, absolutely essential in helping the farming community improve their crop yields and actually deliver food security. We've actually invested about $25 million with various NPOs, working with farmers to equip them with this, you know, with this capability, so that they can improve how they do industrialized and large-scale farming, particularly for subsistence and kind of entry-level farmers to scale their operations. Now, if I talk about education, with capabilities like Google guided learning, for instance, right, in AI, it's almost like a student having a personalized tutor mentor, right? Because this type of AI is not a nanny type of AI, it's a school teacher type of AI, which helps that person learn in the way that they're able to best synthesize and absorb information. So guided learning, for instance, if it's not available in all our official languages, then it is exclusionary for, agricultural farming schools, etc., and those students that are wanting to learn in vernacular or wanting to learn in a language they're most proficient in. So the AI agent becomes almost like a personalized tutor that helps them to learn math and these other sort of STEM subjects in a way that they can best absorb the content. Beyond that, it's also the possibility of using these platforms. For instance, take YouTube as an example. How many students today are able to go back home after, a day at school and use YouTube as a platform to actually deepen their understanding on subject matter and content, right? Mm. It's a practicality, I can talk about it even in the urbanized areas. I have teenagers, right? And oftentimes I am caught wanting about, high school subject matter and content, right? And YouTube is my best friend. And AI is also my best friend, because I use those platforms to actually, help them in sort of solving for some of the difficult problems that they come across. So that's education. There's healthcare. We've got solutions now that have been built on these tools that are helping, prenatal moms, to get access to information, and where clinics are too far for them to, to access, this becomes a platform on mobile that enables them to, let's call it, support themselves throughout their maternity period when they run into issues, etc. It's actually like having a personal, doctor on call, on a mobile device. So there's many applications that enhance people's lives in a fundamental way in how they live, they operate, and also how they improve their own productivity. Least of all, I think what is best understood is in the enterprise space, right? For South African companies, South African enterprises, to remain productive and also to maintain their competitive edge against potential new entrants into the market and disruptors, this is absolutely something that's essential for them to look at, and look at how they're integrated in how they do business. I was just having a conversation with, three CEOs of companies from, across industry, insurance, vehicle and resale and logistics, and we were having this discussion, and for me, it was quite startling how much their lives have become codependent and intertwined with the use of AI in their day-to-day, right? And that tells you something. That tells you it's a profound shift that everybody has to embrace and take advantage of.
Okay, so now talk to me a bit more about the African-specific context. So
yeah.
You're fortunate to work in a company with global oversight of pretty much all of us all the time and all the things we do online.
Yeah.
But what is different about this context, and what do you have to do differently as Google and in your role in order to help individuals and businesses in this continent actually succeed in this globalized landscape? Because we've talked about localization of language and obviously the ability to interact intuitively with technology levels the playing field.
Yes.
But how do you then bring that back to the rest of the world, which is, of course, one of the perpetual struggles with the economics of this continent compared to the rest of the world? How do we work with it and integrate with the global system? And if you have any sort of case studies to point to, great. Otherwise, just interested in your comment there.
So there's a there's a number of South African enterprises that have expansion and global ambitions, right? And in that context, those South African enterprises need to be globally relevant and globally competitive to capture, you know, global audiences and global markets. As an example, you know, recently we launched a partnership with Discovery.
Okay.
Right? Discovery yes. Vitality, right?
Which is global.
Which is global. In their UK operations as well as in their US operations, this partnership will find resonance. Why is this important? Why is this partnership important to Discovery? Discovery's business is anchored on data. It's, you know, its biggest asset is actually how they use data to derive insights on their, you know, let's call it client base, who are insurance customers. And soon to be also, you know, a lot of them will be banking customers, right? Now, in that context, I think we all know how the Vitality, you know, point scoring system works, etc. It fundamentally transforms people's lives in terms of, you know, being health first, right? And helping to shape people's behaviors, right? In terms of in adopting more health-centric form of living, right? Let alone that, but also safer forms of living, because you know, with your, you know, vehicle insurance and so on and so forth, the monitoring of how you drive, et cetera, improves safety, right, on the roads for a lot of their clientele. Vice versa, you know, for them, the benefit is that obviously it lowers the, you know, the cost of the insured, et cetera, and makes them more profitable as a business. But the partnership with Google, right, the partnership is with Google anchors this capability, because we, as a global business, are continuing to innovate at pace with the rest of the world, right? With the rest of the, you know, the counterparts that who are our competitors in this space, to ensure that these models are as efficient, as contextually aware, and you know, they incorporate the latest benefits that an enterprise could derive. You know, from a cloud perspective, from a speed in terms of the actual processes, the TPUs and the GPUs that we use, and the ease of use and accessibility for those enterprises, without which a Discovery would find it very, very difficult to compete in global markets, right? Without that capability, without kind of, let's call it, leveling up to be at par with their global competitors. That's a very practical example of how this technology is being used. I could talk about retailers, for instance, you know, one among which is Woolworths, you know, who is a client of ours. If you think about how people are actually searching, streaming, scrolling, and shopping, right? So from an e-commerce perspective, Woolworths is one. But if I talk about another one, which is Walmart or even Amazon, right, as a customer of a client of Google, these customers are leveraging our e-commerce capabilities to reach, you know, broader audiences, but also to improve the way that they render, you know, shopping ads, as well as suggestions to their user base, which then translates into how much of their products gets sold on their e-commerce platforms. These are just practical examples of how this technology is really helping global players and global enterprises to be relevant and globally competitive and to stay ahead of the competitors.
Okay, so Kabelo, back to you. In terms of looking ahead, you've obviously got some insight, some oversight from your vantage point within the organization that you work with. from your personal perspective, again, speak as far into this question as you are comfortable to do so, what are your biggest projections and predictions as to where AI is headed on the African continent? How are the next 10 years going to play out?
Yeah, so Bronwyn, without giving any predictions in terms of product releases and things like that, it would really not be appropriate. But what I can say, which is very, very clear and directionally evident for where the world is going and also where Google is focused in, is, you know, with Google DeepMind, for instance, there's a big focus around contextual awareness. There's a big focus around making these large language models and these AI agents as autonomous and as human-like, right, in their interactions. So today you have applications of AI in products like, you know, Waymo, for instance. I know Waymo is not available yet in South Africa, but, you know, soon enough it will be, which is, you know, the world is moving towards autonomous vehicles as one case in point. And autonomous vehicles are going to become, you know, the way that the world hails, you know, mobility services. You know, we have hailing services today, which are obviously human operated, but in future this is going to be the mainstay in terms of how people get from point A to point B. And these autonomous vehicles are a medley, actually. This is where you see the integration of different types of technologies coming to being, right? In terms of AI, which is, you know, environmentally and contextually aware of its surroundings, can identify human beings, can identify where contextually in space and time it is, right? Because it's a safety requirement for these vehicles to be on the road. And it's actually quite mind-boggling when you just watch. And then a vehicle that can operate itself, right? Reliant on cloud technology, right? And cloud edge, for instance, which underpins, you know, all these different platforms and enables them to operate at speed. And so, and connectivity becomes a big portion of that, and hence why Google is a massive investor in submarine cables and global connectivity infrastructure. We've also landed a lot of submarine cable systems in South Africa with the Umoja cable system, etc., and Equiano. There's a reason for that, right? Because latency is the enemy of productivity, right? And latency is also the enemy of safety. So when these systems are there, they need to be operating at sub-4 millisecond type of latency. So that's one of the directions, right? Autonomous, and there's also the robotic space. The robotic space, I think we've seen, from some of the players in this market, robots being launched, in many different respects from, you know, personal housekeeping sort of robots that assist you with your domestic requirements to robots that actually will be able to carry large, projects, especially when you think about some of the more dangerous, environments like in, mining and, deep sea type of thing where you would rather spare human life and not let humans do that type of dangerous work. I think the robotic piece is going to find a lot of application. And if you combine robotics with AI, suddenly you have something that could be quite a powerful solution to solve for some of those dangerous professions. And maybe lastly, just in terms of, when you think about another avenue, another area which Google has been focused on from an innovation perspective, which is quantum. And quantum computing, once it becomes commercially viable and productized to, Bronwyn and Gabelo, Joe Soap on the street, I think we're going to see some really, really interesting innovations that take us into the next role.
That's certainly a lot to chew on. I really like your points around the rematerialization of technology, like going from digital back to the real world and those convergences there. Lots of opportunity, lots of interesting things to make people comfortable and uncomfortable and inspired.
Yeah.
But I did have another question for you that I think we'll basically conclude this conversation with, which is quite a hard one, but I think it's important, especially given who you are, your position geographically, and also in terms of the organizations that you work with.
Yeah.
Why and how should African creatives, businesses, politicians, and governments work with international organizations like yourself at Google? And I ask this because you can't help but noticing the sentiments around how governments across the world, but I think particularly in Africa and but less so also in the EU, are suspicious about working with very powerful, very efficient multinational organizations.
Yeah.
But also, as we said, there's suspicion around individuals as to their role and their place when it comes to interacting with large-scale organizations. And how do you answer that point? Because from my perspective, I can clearly see why you can't not be part of technological shifts. And if you don't have the capability to do it yourself, you need to partner with people.
Yeah.
But how do you go about answering that question when asked it directly?
Yeah, look, the reality of it, Bronwyn, is that to do nothing, to your point, and to stand on the sidelines, on the margins, is not an option, right? So the issue of sovereignty, of state versus the big tech, you know, giant influence is what you're alluding to. And I think there's a part of that, and there's a responsibility, and we have many examples now in the rest of the global tech world of how it could be done, and it could be done to the advantage of South Africa, right, as a country. What do I mean by this? Is that there's a lot of money, actually, investment that goes into, you know, launching and making, you know, and building capacity and skilling and so on and so forth when these tech companies enter into specific markets. There's also a lot of physical infrastructure investment.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think is a missed opportunity is how we become more intentional as a country in capturing the lessons learned and then building localized capacity. And localized capacity talks to how, for instance, India as a country started, right? I mean, some of the things are quite fundamental. They are quite rudimentary, if I may even say, to say from an academic perspective, why do you think it's important for Google to partner with tertiary institutions? Well, actually, if you're producing skills that are irrelevant for the future, guess what's going to happen? You're going to just worsen the unemployment problem. So being intentional means fix the structural unemployment issue first, because there are jobs there in the market that, you know, there are vacancies available, but nobody to fill them, because the people who are coming out of university do not have the relevant skills for that, right? That's just the low-hanging fruit. But we are not accelerating in capturing some of that low-hanging fruit enough. And that's my personal opinion, right? And I think that if we do that, and being intentional about how do we kind of restructure pedagogy, and we restructure the teaching and learning so that students that graduate out of university are future fit and future ready, I think would be a big step in the right direction, right? Because also you don't want to, you know, shun these technologies. You don't want to, let's call it, regulate AI into oblivion from a learning perspective, because it's always going to be there. So how do you then integrate it in the teaching and learning process is something to be solved for, right, in curriculum. That's one. The second thing is, for instance, from a tooling perspective in how government delivers, let alone, you know, supports its citizenry, because the main reason for existence of government is to provide social services, right? How much of our social services, you know, are automated today, right, versus that which could be, right? People do not go to websites anymore. People access services through apps on their phones, right? For citizen safety, citizen information, for citizen services, applying for your driver's license, etc., etc., right? I think those things are low-hanging fruit. And then there's the intentionality around creating, let's call it MIT-like institutions in government working with, and I think there's some brilliant work that's being done by the CSIR, but I think it's in the shadows. You need to almost
pull that
out and say, industry, you know, this is a massive capability we have in country, and it's actually quite impactful. How do you actually support an organization like the CSIR to produce research that would be relevant for your particular sector? And there's many, many examples of how this has been done successfully in other parts. For instance, in the defense and aeronautic industry, CSIR is a very, very important entity that's produced some amazing technological innovations, which was exported to the rest of the world. Why can't we scale that? You know, so maybe I'm being simplistic about it, but these are some of the things that I think are there for us to, let's call it, maintain sovereignty, but also position the country in a different way in terms of a formidable global participant. Because we are not short of talent, right? That's a fact. It's just really how we harness that talent and then support institutions that can help to bring that talent to its full potential.
Wise words, of course, when it comes to any sort of economy, and particularly a digitized, globalized, connected economy. It only works when people participate in it together, when people share together. But of course, people are looking for that reciprocity to flow both ways, right? To make sure that people's ideas are valued, like you've spoken about in the copyright conversation, and the people are compensated and feel like they're getting something out of participating. Yeah. But not participating is, of course, a massive own goal. We have to work with people. We have to work together. We have to create partnerships and cross over our divides and prejudices to move forward, to embrace the entirety of what is possible for technology, AI, and everything when it comes to our continents and, of course, connecting with the whole world.
Absolutely.
And that's a wrap for today. Thank you so much, Bello, for sharing your insights on how AI, language, and innovation are unlocking new possibilities for education, business, growth, and partnerships, importantly, across the African continent. We've unpacked how Google's investments in African and vernacular language technologies are not just connecting more people, they're helping us imagine an Africa that's ready to leapfrog into the future with creativity, intelligence, and cultural pride. If you found this episode inspiring or thought-provoking, please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us on Wrapped Biz Trends TV, as well as on Biz Community's official platforms, The Real Neat Network, YouTube, and of course on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. On behalf of myself, Bronwyn Williams, and my guest today, and the teams at Biz Community and Rap Creative, thank you again for tuning in. We'll see you next time next year as we continue to decode the trends shaping Africa's future.